72 of IU Vietnam. Being interviewed will be Captain Raymond Dobbins, who was the acting senior advisor of the 42nd during Tan Can. Arrived in country, and when were you assigned to the 42nd?
I arrived in country 27 August 72 and was assigned to the 42nd. But arrived at the 42nd, Tan Can, 2nd or 3rd of September, same year.
Where was the area of operations for the 42nd at this time?
Right, this time the 42nd VO extended over to about 3 kilometers east of Van Gett. We got no northern boundary. The southern boundary was halfway, approximately halfway between Canton and Tan Can, and had no western boundary, or no eastern boundary, excuse me.
What type of operations were being conducted?
Generally, the regiment was in a defensive posture. We had fire base 5 and 6 with a requirement to keep at least one battalion on each fire base. We had the defensive Tan Can, which is a large area. And we also had defensive Dokto 2, which is an airstrip, required approximately half a battalion at each location of those, Tan Can and Dokto 2. We had also a battalion located at Canton for a total of 4 battalions. We were manned in this posture most of the majority of the time, in defensive type setup.
When did you first, what first indication did you get that there was going to be a major offensive conducted in the Tan Can area?
No, Mr. Vance talking to the press. We spread out through the press quite often, and we got indications of it back, I'd say, in November when we started receiving road buildups, cross-border type operations with CCC, of course, was classified and not made available to us. But we first got indications, and it was late November when the buildup was actually pushing down and starting. We requested surveillance type aircraft, and in no October, I think it was, all surveillance aircraft left MRT, so we had no surveillance aircraft. But from November on up to, until the division forward moved our location in January, we were getting indications of road building south of Fire Base 6, and coming out of base area more or less 609 over there, coming into the Canton province. The major portion of it was just road building operations. We went on several offensive type operations, made several good sized contacts that seemed to be staging areas. One of them was to the east of Tan Can, about 17 or 18 kilometers. This was conducted in January. 14-day operation. We went into a good-sized base area in that location. And at that time, it was occupied, so we had a good operation. But we had indications of it leading up to it, I'd say, from the back end of November sometime.
So what type of reaction in the 42nd when you were discovering it? What type of operations did they conduct and attempt to develop targets?
The 42nd conducted work operations, mainly. We started getting the requirement to cut down on Fire Base 5 and 6, the manpower required up there. So we could man it with one battalion. We could split the battalion and man both fire bases. So that left us one battalion that we could operate in offense with. So we started going on operations, offensive type operations, would break more, at least one battalion, in some cases two battalions away. We were doing an offensive operation. We did pull our 3rd battalion back from Canton area. It was in January when we did this. And so that left us 2 battalions that we could maneuver with most of the time. And the majority of the time, from late November to the time we were overrun, Tan Can was hit bad, we were conducting offensive type operations.
What type of support were you getting both from the Arvin and the U.S. during these offensive operations?
Okay, the U.S. artillery was pulled out of Tan Can immediately after I went there in September. on that day in September. So we had no U.S. artillery support, with the exception of 175s from Kantoum. And we went on a couple of operations down south towards Kantoum, and to actually just north of Kantoum. And we were supported at that location, the 175s, but they left country in, I think it was November when they left. Arvin artillery, we had numerous artillery pieces, never operated outside of the Arvin artillery fence, and it was adequate artillery. U.S. air, we're getting very little U.S. air until the actual offenses, you know, started breaking out. We could definitely tell there was an offense coming. We worked the air cab quite often in the area. Sometimes we work weeks on time on the air cab operations. So support-wise, I think we had pretty good support. We were out there. Was great. They're accurate. We did have a few problems starting up with the Huey type operations, helicopter, slick operations. But nothing that was real drastic, especially up until the big offensive and big police came and we were getting a lot of anti-aircraft fire.
What about arc-light strikes?
Our flight strikes are good, outstanding, but they never get placed in the location that the advisor on the ground wants them. As an example, we've got too many safety factors built into them. The advisor on the ground working directly with the Arvin to build an arc light. It goes into division. Division changes it just a little bit, safety factor. It goes to 2 Corps. 2 Corps changes it a little bit more for safety factors. It goes to Mike B, where it was approved, shotgun. And they change it a little bit more. So when it comes back and is laid in, it might be as much as 2, 3, 4 kilometers off target from where the advisor on the ground wants it. So there is a factor that's built in that they've got to go by, I imagine. But it's not too responsive as far as defensive or an offensive type weapon, as far as I'm concerned. North Vietnamese use our arc lights. They know that once we put one in one location, we're not going to expand another one for a couple of weeks. So we found that they were moving right back into an arc light location, possibly the next day after putting them in.
Well, now I'd just like for you to start when you considered the situation to be getting critical at Tan Can, and go through kind of a chronological order on the events that happened as far as you experienced them.
About 10 days before we were really good at Tan Can, the senior advisor went on leave. The 1st of April, though, we started getting periodically incoming type rounds of ammunition. I estimated it to be 122 field gun type and 130 field gun type. And we knew that the 320th NVA division and the 2nd NVA division, which was opposing us, had the 122 and 130 ESPs. And they had a range of about 27 kilometers. They sit out 27 kilometers and just lob all the time around they want to in on you. And you have nothing really to count on because all we had was, most of it was 155. And so when they started using this type of ammunition on us around the first part of April, especially around the 10th of April, then we pretty well knew that we were going to get something in, ground attack or something. And we captured several little documents that said that Tan Can was a major target, with Kantoum being the secondary target when they had taken Tan Can. We even captured a drawing on how they were going to take Tan Can, but it didn't pay off, the way the drawing had depicted it. On about the 12th or 13th of the month, we started getting sappers trying to reach the perimeter and just come in and make reconnaissance, A lot of the sappers were killed. almost kill one every night with mech ambushes, mechanical ambushes, which the Yarvin are very efficient at setting up. At first, they only had the pull-type device on the mech ambushes, and we were getting them cut. So then we started putting a pull-release type. So what it is just a field expedient device that we rig up, and if they cut the thing, it goes off also, same as it would if it was tripped. So we were getting average of sopper a night from about the 18th thrown up until we got hit. The disposition of forces, Arvin has never operated at company level, on company operations, except for the reconnaissance company. They've always operated at battalion level operations. We had a big push on in April there to get the Arvin to operate its companies, separate companies. And we sent our first battalion. We had about 400 men in it, up to the east of Tancan. This was about Friday before we got hit, which would make the date the 21st. They've been fighting up there since about the 17th. They were overrun on the 21st with no ammunition to defend with. They came back in the next morning, Saturday morning, the 22nd, with he had a total of 27 men. So that's the status of one battalion, and Tancan was hit. Another battalion, which was at Doughton Moat, we pulled them back in towards Tancan on Friday, the 21st. They had one company across on the eastern side of Tancan, and the battalion minus was still just north of Tancan, right outside the perimeter, really. And the enemy shifted his artillery. And this battalion had, I think it was 68 casualties on Saturday. So we were receiving a lot of artillery. I estimated 1,000 rounds a day a week preceding the 23rd when they hit us hard. And then on the Saturday and Sunday, which the day before, which Saturday and Sunday was the 22nd and 23rd. They hit us with about 2,000 rounds of artillery a day. And it was a lot, we had a lot of death rate. It seemed like they just put them out to get the ammunition out. And I estimated a 60% death rate because it's five whole valleys, you know, and not a one of them exploded. But even the death had a big effect on the troops up there. In Tancan perimeter itself, on the morning of the 24th, we had 300 combat troops and 900 support troops in the division. The division support troops were not organized into any counterattack force that I know of. So that was pretty well the disposition of our forces. We had one battalion that was at north of Tancan up around Bakto District Headquarters, and on Saturday the 22nd, Friday the 21st, we moved them south to Zinbin Bridge instead of the fire base there. We had one battalion of the 41st attached to us, I think it was the 41st or the 41st, and our first battalion got overrun on the hill east of Tancan. We committed the 41st battalion up there, and they were in a status of being overrun themselves at the time we got here on Monday morning. So that's pretty well a disposition of all of our forces. We fire base 5 and 6 at that time were manned by a Ranger battalion. And Bakto 2, airstrip area, of course, was 47th area. So Tancan area itself, that's pretty well the setup on our troops. On Saturday morning, no, Friday, it was Saturday morning, we encountered our first wire defense guided missile, or wire-type guided missile, fired at us. It streaked over the town of Tancan, came from northeast, just up around the pagoda area. They were going up the area, there's a pagoda northeast of Tancan, but anything north of that was considered fair game to us. They set up behind the pagoda and fired these wire-guided missiles. And we only fired a few of them on Saturday. And we got word that they were firing him because the regimental commander and I were in the village. And some of the villagers pointed out this wire to us. And then, of course, we policed up some of the wire and sent it in. It was going to be sent in to two corps for observation, you know, for analysis to see what kind it was. But unfortunately, it never did get sent in. On Sunday, they hit the... First off, on Sunday, we had a good battalion-sized contact. We thought it was a squad contact outside, just outside of Oklahoma on the eastern side. The enemy had dug in that location. And we sent a sweep out. It was a platoon sweep, and they engaged, and they thought they'd engaged the squad. But later on, we found out it was much more than a squad, and from the volume of fire and everything that we drew from that location, we figured it was at least a battalion. But we had tanks attached to us. We pulled out of the 10-can perimeter with four tanks to go down and reinforce our infantry to sweep that area. And of course, they got online and was moving forward. Small arc fire, and a crewman got hit, wounded on the head. So the tank pulled back and went up to the gate of Tadcat. He no sooner stopped to unload his wounded man, one of his wide-headed missiles hit him. The rest of the tanks were all knocked out with the wide-headed missile system.
These were the other three besides this one there?
We had three and one. The other thing is, we had one other one in the front of the area, and it was all of them of T-41s,
M-41s.
And we had one more inside the perimeter Sunday night, and we didn't have a crew for the thing. All the crews had been piled up at one way or the other. So we lost the two main bunkers that were overlooking the road approach to Tan Camp through the wide-headed missile system. Also, on one of these bunkers was a 106, which we had used and planned to use in our tank defense role. The other 106 was knocked out by possibly a B-40 round. On Monday morning or Sunday night, they also lined up about, I'd estimate 20 or 30 B-40 and B-41 gunners, you know, just to the north of Tan Camp, and they fired over the L-19 strip into the ammo dump and tried to set it on fire, which they were successful in doing. This was Sunday night.
How many wire-guided missiles would you estimate were fired?
On Saturday, they only fired maybe three or four. But on Sunday, it's hard to tell because explosions going off all around, you know. We've got about 2,000 rounds of ammo in that day. And how many of these were wire-guided missiles, I don't know.
I understand somebody from the 42nd went out and retrieved one that was a dud or exploded.
This happened in Antioch.
Well, there was. I had Major Weiss said something about.
We had some wire.
A U.S. going out on the morning of the 22nd, right before the one hit the top.
Well, it may have. I don't really know. I was not with the division advisor people. I was out trying to get the contact that was to the eastern side of the perimeter. I was trying to do something out there and get a little fishing weight on that side. When the DTOP received their round and it went through the generator shacks there and set the top on fire that fast, like, so they might have found one. I wouldn't say so, or they would have. I just wasn't with the division people that much, and radio communications, I held it down to a minimum unless I was working with guns or specter type aircraft. On Sunday night, about midnight, after we had taken a real shelling all day that day, pretty well knocked out all of our top locations, DTOP advisors or division advisors had moved up to the Mighty Peak compound at the top. And I was located down with the regimental commander in his top. And I had one other advisor with me, Captain Yoder. Ken Gillen. And Ken was advising the assistant or deputy regimental commander. And the regimental commander sent his deputy up in the water tower to assist the Jeff and I cover an airplay. And even with an advisory concept of where your counterpart goes, you go, Ken went with it. An outstanding job of conducting Spectre gunships and airstrikes here up until they got so bad that they couldn't get shot. Also had a lot of gunships. We put gunships in daily. I think I had six sets of guns working, and six sets is 12 guns. So I had guns on station all day Sunday, and the last way after about it Sunday night they were still shooting. We still had the infantry dug in out on the wire and never did break them loose, really. So Ken was up in the water tower and I was down about 400 meters away from him on the regimental CP. When Spectre aircraft reported that he picked up a tank column headed towards Bato District coming from the west, and which would put it just north of Ben Hett area, coming straight across due east towards Bato District. We thought district headquarters was their target, and Spectre was engaging them with his ordnance. He counted, I think it was 10 in a report of 18 to 22 vehicles. And they moved in, moved all the way up towards Bato District, and then they swung south. And we had been on operation about a week earlier in that location with tanks. So we had already proved that all the bridges in the area would hold all their armored vehicles when we went over for hours. They swung south and used the exact approach that we had used.
Was there any plans to blow these bridges since it was obvious they could have blown them?
There was plans to blow them, but unfortunately we didn't have any control over the bridges. They were all manned by popular force troops.
Bato District then had the control over the...
They were all rigged to blow, and every one of them was controlled by Bato District.
Did you have any communication at all with Bato District? Or?
Yes, we had communication with them. We were on our frequencies. Unfortunately, also, the people that were in charge of holding that bridge had left the area. We didn't have any contact with them.
How many bridges were there?
There were two bridges. Either one of them could stop the oncoming tanks. This Spectre engaged these tanks and it stopped. And he would quit working on that when he claimed material. Quit working on that when he moved to another one. Later on, we got calls from the popular forces. These tanks that he claimed to knock out started back up again and were back in the column. They pulled all the way into Tancan city limits or right at the northern checkpoint of Tancan. They stopped and they dismounted their troops that were riding on them. All the troops rode on the tanks and were close troops. 10 of the tanks backed off and went around north and came in and set up on the L-19 strip and supported by fire the next morning when they actually did the assault. The remaining tanks, which Arvin reported 18, came and lined up right in front of the main gate, right on the road. And we could hear them all night, you know, running around, tanks. We had made the one company into a tank killer team, and they claimed to destroy two tanks and Tancan itself with a lot. And at approximately 5:30 or 6:15 in the morning, it was still hazy and just beginning to break light. They turned their headlights on their tanks, and a big long column of tanks with their headlights on, you know, coming into the perimeter.
Were they in column or in line?
They were in line. And the ones at the L-19 strip were in column and started firing their main guns at doctors and stuff, you know, from the side of the tunnel. At the same time, well, the ones that came through the main gate were all supported by infantry with them. As the tanks came through, the infantry started shooting the bunker lines. And I estimated a couple of battalions of infantry, but they might have been, you know, less or more. I don't really know. Anyway, we had another infantry attack, a straight infantry attack, from the south. And that tied up our bunker line on the south, southern portion. So they had a good three-pronged attack on us. And we had nothing to counter the armor except law. And very few of those that were actually tied up.
I understood there were 6 106s brought up to Tancan. Was that?
2 106s at Tancan perimeter. We had 2 at Dock Boat, 2 at Dock 36.
And one of these was the one that was knocked out, yeah, you mentioned previously? What happened to the other one?
I don't really know, unless it was abandoned or knocked out one way or another. But psychological effect of these tanks. It just got too much for the troops. And the division advisors were picked up very early in the game. Really before too much activity was going on, they were in a helicopter.
What about what time is this?
I don't know really, because I wasn't watching the clock. I called them and they said they were going out the wire, and it was no more than 30 minutes after the assault started. So they wanted to know my location. I gave it to them, but I was in a different position than they were in, because I was the only U.S. there. You know.
Where were you at the time of the attack then?
At the time of the attack, I was sitting at the main gate of 27 Arbor. And
this is where
the armor came through.
The armor, the 18, about 18, is that?
That's what
Arvin counted. How many did you see yourself?
It was just a whole line of lights. I didn't take time to count lights.
And this is right up, this is on the main gate, around the main gate of the perimeter?
Yes, the main gate of the compound. We only had one gate. It was on the northeastern side of the perimeter.
And then what happened when after the U.S. were evacuated? What were your actions?
After the U.S. were evacuated, I couldn't talk to anyone except facts. And we still had ground cover, and they couldn't lay in airstrikes on them at the time. And when the ground cover lifted, or the fog lifted, which was about 7:15 or 7:30, somewhere around that area, then the high-performance aircraft would work in the area, and we started bringing in, laying in air on the tanks. And rotated the regimental commander lay in a set of VNAFs, you know, depending on who had the most fuel at the time. And if VNAF was about out of fuel, we'd lay them in first, you know, and let ours loiter a lot. But there were just targets up there, unlimited targets for them. Mr. Van was the only U.S. I could talk to other than the fact, and he ordered a reinforced column out of this. The battle was while they were still picking up advisors. He ordered a couple of tanks and at least a company to reinforce us from Dock Toe 2. They moved out about 200 meters from Dock Toe 2, and the fact said, if those are your tanks coming up the road, so they're destroyed now. They got something destroyed them from the north of the road, you know. So the two tanks got about 200 or 300 meters from Dock Toe, and Dock Toe 2 and were hit by some type of anti-tank weapon. And so that stopped the reinforcements. The regimental commander could talk only periodically to the division commander. We didn't really know his true location, so the last time we seen him was Sunday evening at they were might be compound. And the only U.S. that I could talk to was Mr. Van and
Right. Did you have any contact with Captain Yeoman in the tower at this time?
The last contact I had with Ken was about 6:30 in the morning, and I told him to get out of the water tower, and he said he couldn't, and he didn't elaborate, and I didn't push it in.
Just a few short years ago, I played a lot with Bill and Joe. They seemed to think that I was quite a guy. I could climb the highest tree, and they would always follow me. We had friendship I thought would never die. But soon I changed from tomboy girl and grew into a woman's world. I moved away, leaving my old friends. Now I'm miles and years away, but I still dream of childhood days, and I wish I was a little boy again. But girls grow into women, and boys grow into men, and the world of make-believe all too soon must end. And I blame that awful change for the shape my life is in. Oh, I wish I was a little boy again. I married someone they don't know, and socially they're far below the kind of life that I now have to live.
Well, this is a continuation of the interview with Captain Dominguez. So would you start now? We're about 6:30 in the morning when we last talked to Captain Yonan. What occurred after this time? You've been directing in your air targets, and what were your actions during this
period? Okay, the last time I talked to Captain Yonan there, the NBA had already pierced the perimeter, and on the northeastern side, through the main gate. And the southern side, the infantry had already breached the perimeter there also. The recon company was on the southern side, and they claimed at that time to have over 100 kills in the wire, which I never could confirm. We just never did make it around to that side of the perimeter. The tanks moved in, swept through the perimeter, and during the entire attack, and up until about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, they were still firing the artillery. They never shut the artillery off. These tanks were excellent targets for the airstrikes. The fire would roll in and mark the tank, and the tank would stop. No evasion action. And some of the tracks were, we'd call them a quad 40 type operation on them. Sound like a duster with a slow timing. And every time a fire or a high-performance aircraft would roll in, they would fire this thing, and it would just go chug-chug, you know, and chug-chug. It sounded like an industrial wheel, like I said before, with a head spell and timing set slow on it. But it wasn't any aircraft type weapon, and we kept giving these to the facts first. As soon as we located one, we'd give it to the fact. We just basically went from bunker to bunker and crawled around, and sometimes we had recoveries and this type of stuff. There was about 20-something of us, and every now and then we'd engage the enemy and pull back. But basically what we were trying to do was to reorganize the regiment and get some type of defense going.
This is with your counterpart?
Right.
It's right with, well, I haven't gotten his name yet. Who was your...
Lieutenant Colonel Tong, T-H-O-N-G. But he lost contact with all of his elements about 10 o'clock in the morning. And at this time, we continued to find targets for the air. And they were not too hard to find. You could hear a tank rumbling around, you know. And when a fight would go off station, it seemed that they would try to move their tanks, you know, just keep them where the next fight wouldn't find them. And we kept turning these locations to the fights and adjusting their strikes on them. And the northwestern portion of the perimeter was breached by the tanks, and the infantry breached it first, and then the tanks breached it. But we went into a hidden bunker that evidently a couple of regimental commanders ago had built, and been passed down through the chain of command as to where this bunker was. And fortunately for us, it was there because we went into it. I had 19 Army soldiers, most of them officers with me. And we stayed there throughout the rest of the day.
Where was this bunker located?
It was at Colonel Towns' house.
Which is with
Regimental Commander's house.
This is within the 42nd perimeter then?
Right. It was within the perimeter. And we stayed there until 8 o'clock that, about 7:30, 8 o'clock that night. Periodically, we'd go out and check to see what was going on. But basically, there was not that much fighting going on. There was still resistance being offered in specific bunker areas, you know. But we could talk to no one on the radio and even no one on the ground from maneuver elements on the radio. So we just felt like we didn't have any other means to resist, you know, other than what we could put in from the air. Fire base 5 and 6, well, that was the next day they were evacuated. But they had 105s on fire base 5, which were just were about 600 or 700 meters short of reaching our location to support us. So all of our indirect fire was cut out, and no indirect fire weapons to support. That night, about 2,000 hours, we broke up into three-man groups and tried to meet in India. At that time, the moon was just a little bit too high, too bright, and we got detected trying to go out the western side of the perimeter. It was really going out southwest. Got detected and lost a couple of men there. We come back. Instead of going back into the bunker that we'd hit in that day, we went under I guess you'd call it a pig pen type location where you had hogs on one level, you know, and PSP on the top of it. It was right on the bunker line on the eastern side. And we hit out there until around midnight. We tried another attempt. And at that time, we had Spectre up in the area, and he was illuminating. And got some illumination behind us. Sort of left us detected again, so we pulled back. The moon went down about 4 in the morning. And at that time, we also had a pretty good ground fog, which assisted us, myself and my interpreter, and Colonel Tong and his secretary, which was a good time. We made it out the western side of the perimeter and policed up some men that had went through a minefield and were pretty well wounded up, messed up, so policed them up and moved on south. And we picked up about 2 kilometers south of Kempton.
Who picked you up?
The aircraft next morning.
I've had some reports that once this increasing volumes of fire began to come in on Tan Can, that the artillery there did not respond to it, any type of counter battery fire. Can you give me any light in this?
Well, on Friday we got a lot of rockets. Friday before we got hit, we got a lot of rockets from the base of Firebase 5. We were between Firebase 5 and Yankee. And we had FO teams on Firebase 5 and 6, U.S. type FO teams. We were trying to resupply the 1st Battalion, which was completely out of ammunition, trying to resupply with Phenow. They took a lot of ground fire and wouldn't go back in. So what we were doing, we had to go to Kontoon to refuel. And Tan Can started taking incoming rockets. All right, so we flew over the rocket ridge, as we call it, the rocket belt, and we could see them firing the rockets. All right, we had a fight. It was coming on station, but we had to leave station to get POL. All right, I turned in a 6-digit coordinates on these rocket positions, which was well within artillery fan, and Colonel Tom cranked his artillery up into that location. And I gave 6-digit coordinates back into the top, and we went on to get POL, and we came back, and they laid the air in about 500 meters off of that coordinates that I'd given them based on the ground FO team at Firebase 5, which couldn't observe the rockets being fired, but they could hear them. And we had an error there, you know. We had to suffer. We detected their 122 and 130 gun positions, which Colonel Cito did about a month before we were overrun. And David requested arc light specifically on their positions. And to this day, I don't think an arc light's went on. These were outside of the fire plan of any of our artillery. And but to answer your question specifically on outgoing artillery that we had incoming, it was very little from the location.
How would you classify the leadership within the 42nd?
All right. The regimental leadership was outstanding. We had two battalion commanders that I considered outstanding. And we had two that were more or less, they weren't great, but they weren't the worst that I've seen. The leadership at company level is, it was very difficult to make an assessment on it because you've never seen the companies operate individually, except for the recon company, and the recon company commander was outstanding, it was a lieutenant. But the situation at Tancan, the regimental commander could maneuver two companies. He could not maneuver a battalion. And, of course, this goes back into some political activity here that we're not supposed to discuss too much. But anyway, all he could maneuver was two companies. Anything over a battalion or up higher than two companies had to come from the division. And the regimental commander had no say-so in at all in how his troops were. The disposition of his troops.
Could he ask to come in a certain way?
And he could ask, but very seldom do you find an Arvin leader that after he asks over a couple of times, he won't come back and ask anymore. And that's what a lot of cases, you know, you'll find that this learns good leadership. It's detrimental leadership where you can't maneuver your forces the way you want to. So, he had no choice in where his troops were. I think his troops would have held much better had we had the division headquarters at Khantoum or someplace. Didn't have 900 support troops trying to get away from some tanks. Of course, once support troops broke, his troops broke. That was a big part of it. Just the lack of coordination, lack of organization, really, that big mob that the division had up there. I think Colonel Kaplan would agree with it.
When you were, do you have any personal opinions on what caused the as far as any reasons that you feel that the Tancan happened as it was, but other than this, the support troops being around where they were, any personal observations might assist and help to evaluate?
No. We had the airborne up there for a while, and the airborne had unlimited supplies of artillery and aviation. They were supported by division, you know, 22nd Division supply channels. The ammunition rate got down to where we could fire 20 rounds for each tube of ammunition we had. This was about, I guess the situation lasted about a week before we were overrun. That's about all we could fire. An ASR, you know, of 20 rounds per day for tubes. And when you limit someone on their artillery support, you're really taking a lot away from the troops. But had we been able to resupply the 1st Battalion, which was east of Tancan, had they held, you know, if we just got ammunition to them, I think they would have held.
They were totally out of all kinds of
arms? They were completely out of everything. So they walked back in with 27 men. I guess the remainder was men he had. The fact that we didn't have anything to engage Army with is another big factor. And also the fact that we didn't really expect that much armor to come into us. We still had, the last intelligence we had was 6 to 8 1876 is the base area, 6 to 9. So we had nothing to base a big armor attack on, no intelligence. And except for a little bit of network that they were building. And in these road building networks, we employed alerts and on numerous occasions to put out the anti-tank mining. I think they got 3 truck kills confirmed, you know. Trucks hitting the mines for a minute. They had plenty of ammunition and everything up there. We really didn't have that much to combat them with.
Do you have any other, anything else that might assist in writing the history, or any other observations?
No, not really. Unless you've got some questions, I'm going to ask somebody else's.
Well, there was one other indication I had when situation was thought to be critical was when this goes back to the division staff, the division G3 had been falsifying positions. Do you have any knowledge of any of this? He had supposedly, the battalions he said were on the ridge line to the east were up on the battalion was up on the ridge, it was on the military crest of the hill and was moving forward, and when actually it was on the reverse slope moving to the rear. Was this the battalion that was out of ammunition and that was the reason, or was, do you have any further knowledge of that?
No, I don't. That was division level. 1st and 41st on Friday was ordered up to reinforce the 1st and the 42nd, which was getting over on that hill. It run out of ammunition, it was running out. And the location that the DTOC had did not correspond with the location that the regiment had. That's the location of that battalion. And I took a helicopter out on Saturday morning, or no, it was Friday evening, and verified the location, and the location that the regiment had on them was a correct location. But the location the division had on Friday was a good kilometer and a half off. But I don't know whose fault it was, and was plotting it and reporting it, but you don't get these people to spot smoke when you fly over them, you know, you pretty well tell if they're dead. But, from their poncho tents and this type of stuff.
Hey, I'm trying to get all the names straight. On the 47th team was Colonel Cito, before he went on R&R there, and then it was yourself and Captain Young.
Right.
With the 47th at Dock Toe, it was Colonel Brownlee.
Colonel Brownlee and Captain Carden.
And Captain Carden. Those were the only two there. And then with the division people, Colonel Kaplan, Colonel McLean, Major Weiss, Captain Stewart, Lieutenant Jones, Major Warmoth. Jones and Warmoth, or Warmoth was injured in a helicopter crash, and Jones was killed in that. Was there anyone else that?
We had Major Carter, which was a cavalry advisor, and we also had Sergeant Ward, which was a administrative type NCO that was assigned to the, or he was attached to the 42nd RCAT to assist us while the division team was up there, the administrative and supply functions. And we had a Spec 4 Zollicoffer, which was a medic that was attached for the same purposes, only for when the division team was up. That's when we had those two individuals. The rest of the time, the RCAT only called for 3 men. The cattle on the call for one. As I said before, these two NCOs or two men were there to assist us. Charlie Copper was killed in the helicopter crash, or afterwards. And Sergeant Ward was picked up out of the helicopter crash a few days later.
Okay, sir, I have nothing further. You don't have any other observations?
Not unless you've got some gaps you want to, or some, I possibly had some light to.
I can't think of anything. If If I do, I'll probably have to make a trip back over before he degrows. Okay. This concludes the interview with Captain Donovan, all of which will proceed as classified confidential, no form. Thank you.